This is the Graceful Atheist Podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast. My name is David, and I am trying to be the Graceful Atheist. I want to thank my latest raters and reviewers on the Apple Podcast Store. Thank you to Tom and XFundy. And on Podchaser.com, thank you to JoJo. Thank you so much for rating and reviewing the podcast. You too can rate and review the podcast on either the Apple Podcast Store or Podchaser.com. And remember to subscribe to the podcast wherever you are listening. That actually does help. Special thanks to Mike T for editing today's podcast. On to today's show. My guests today are Lars, Christy, Teddy, Amy, and Eleanor. And this is the story of an entire family who went through a deconstruction, deconversion process and ultimately stopped going to church during the 2020 pandemic. I loved these guys so much. What they have to say is incredible. Lars and Christy are incredibly intelligent and articulate in the way that they describe what they went through. It's also fascinating. You're going to hear from both of them in ways that intelligence enabled them to continue on in the faith longer than they would have otherwise. So I think their story is really important, and I think you're going to find quite a bit to relate to. I want to thank Lars and Christy here to say thank you for allowing me to learn in the process of doing a multiple person interview. I've only been able to do that one other time with Caroline and Andreas. Caroline's episode aired. Our conversation together did not. And that is a lot due to my inability to handle an interview with multiple people at the same time. So thank you to both families, Caroline and Andreas, and to Lars and Christy and family for allowing me to gain some experience and learn in this process. So if the transitions from person to person feel a little awkward, that's on me. But again, I think their telling of the story is really important. Lastly, I'll just say the old adage of never work with children or pets is absolutely true. You will hear at the end of the interview, Teddy, Amy, and Eleanor, and they, of course, steal the show, and nothing goes according to script, as it were. I just want to make it clear here that we weren't trying to do any leading questions there. We were just trying to elicit out of them statements they had already made to their parents, Lars and Christy. So it's very cute, but I hope you enjoy that and know that I wasn't trying to deconvert small children. That is definitely not my goal. With all of that, here is my conversation with Lars, Christy, Teddy, Amy, and Eleanor. Lars and Christy, welcome to the Graceful Atheist Podcast.
Thank you.
Hey, you guys reached out to me, and Lars, you mentioned that your family kind of went through a deconversion process almost simultaneously. Do you want to just introduce yourselves, your family, and we'll jump into your religious history after that?
Sure. I was raised as the son of a missionaries and then later preacher, living in the house church that we went to, so I never really had the option of not going.
Okay.
And I was perhaps much less emotionally attached to the faith than many others. I was more intellectually attached because for me, my primary motivators have always been truth and duty. And so because the faith was presented as true, it was thus the onus on me to follow it and to practice it to the best of my ability.
Yeah.
So we went to Awana. We were homeschooled to make sure that we only got Christian teaching.
Yes.
We lived in the church, as I mentioned. We went on not too many mission trips as pastor's kids, but you know, the first few years of my life were spent in the mission field, and I voluntarily went on a missions trip shortly after graduating college. And you know, overall, I took it very seriously. I wanted to know more. I wanted to be able to live the best Christian life I could.
Right.
Unfortunately, of course, I never really felt any great desire to share this with other people. In retrospect, I suspect it's because I didn't find it all that convincing and didn't think I'd be able to convince anybody else. But that's hindsight, and it may or may not be entirely accurate.
Yeah.
So we can get into more details later, but suffice it to say, Eventually, I came with some doubts that I could not overcome. And initially, Christy and I discussed these together.
Okay.
And after a while, I stopped discussing it because I was worried that I was throwing off her faith and didn't want to do that to her.
Yeah. So, Christy, if you want to just tell us briefly your religious history as well, and then kind of bring us up to speed.
Sure. So I grew up in a Southern Baptist house, basically. My dad was in the Air Force, and we moved around a little bit, but we mostly went to Southern Baptist churches. I also did the Awana program pretty much the whole way through, memorizing Bible verses,
yeah.
Got the main award at the end of that program. I also was part of the Girls in Action in my church as a young girl. Went on some mission trips in middle school. When we were living in Hawaii, we went to some of the other islands to do vacation Bible school.
Okay.
With some of the kids on a couple of the less affluent islands in Hawaii. And then I continued to go on other mission trips throughout, high school, college, and even afterwards. I was homeschooled from fifth through ninth grade for similar reasons. I was taught that evolution wasn't true. And I went to a Christian high school and a Christian college. After college, I spent a year in China, at least sort of as a missionary, ostensibly. But the way that we presented it to the Chinese public was that we were there teaching English.
Right.
So I was teaching English and chemistry in China, and it was with a group from my Christian college, but we had all graduated.
Okay.
The idea was to, tell about Jesus, but it didn't really happen all that much.
I think that's a pretty common story for missionaries is you go with the intention of evangelizing and then realize that, it's a completely different culture and you don't have a lot to say to a person in this different culture. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, Lars, in your email to me, it sounds like young earth creationism was a major, both part of your early faith and then part of the deconversion process for you. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Oh, absolutely. My parents tell me that I have always been a scientist. One of the first things I did when I was able to walk, and I don't even remember this, of course, was I found a magnet and started sticking it to things. And ever afterwards, I would never try it on anything that wasn't metal. Even before I could talk, I was doing experiments and finding the results. So these were always very important things to me. And one of the first things that stands out in my memory of trying to find out more about the world was asking my mom, how old is the Earth? And of course, she responded somewhere around 10,000 years old. And it seems weird, but that very specific moment sticks in my head, but I can still remember being like 4 and a half looking up at her, not that far up. She's not very tall, but
neither was my mom. So,
and it, I remembered that very well. And in the 90s, we went to a Ken Ham seminar and a Dwayne Gish debate. And for some reason, maybe just because I just didn't like sitting in church, so I didn't like sitting in lectures either, I didn't really take in the specific things they were saying, but I was enamored of the idea that evidence can support a view. Mm. And I grew up assuming that evidence did in fact support young earth creationism, although I never really looked that much into it. I also have a really good memory. I just remember all kinds of random things that I encounter, hear, read, watch, whatever. And over many years, I accidentally learned how evolution works. I didn't realize this until it was late 2013 or early 2014. My brother, who was deconverting a bit before me, posted a link. I guess he was still in his deconstruction phase, if you will, posted a link to a now defunct site called God of Evolution, entitled Top 10 Signs You Don't Understand Evolution at All. And I looked at that and I remember I was terrified, but I also knew that if I didn't click on it, I would be a coward. So I clicked on it to see what it said, and it confirmed exactly what I clearly knew at some level, that I actually did understand evolution, that it was true, and that I had no reason to keep denying it.
Right.
And practically overnight, my confidence in the idea of God went from over 50% to less than 10. I remember kind of spiraling, calling some of my spiritual mentors and asking them, you know, what should I do? I've just realized, hey, all this stuff that I've been taught is not true.
Right.
And what am I going to do? And I said out loud, it's not like I doubt the existence of God or anything. And as soon as I said it, I knew that it wasn't true.
Mm.
I knew that I not only doubted the existence of God, I didn't actively believe anymore. But for the next 7 years or so, I kept trying. So I guess the bare minimum of faith is hope. And I had that for a while.
I love it. I love it.
But I never really had a strong attachment to the faith. Like, I never liked the character of God. I always found Jesus boring. I didn't enjoy church, but I did it anyway because, again, it was true and it was my duty.
Well, thank you for that honesty, because I think there's plenty of people, butts in the seats and the pews, rather, that are, you know, bored out of their minds, but they're there out of a sense of duty. I think that's really true. And then, Christy, it sounds like you're a scientist as well, if you were teaching chemistry. So what part did that play for you? First of all, were you taught young earth creationism? And then was that a part of the process for you as well?
Yeah, so I was taught young earth creationism growing up, starting when I was homeschooled and then continuing on into high school and beyond. My high school took a trip to a conference called the Origins Conference at Bryan College in Dayton, Tennessee, which is the city where the Scopes trial was.
Ah, okay.
And the idea of the conference was young earth creationism. And so they had quote unquote scientists, you know, talking about how, you know, science confirms young earth creationism.
Right.
It was pushed pretty heavily in my school. In my physiology class, I read the book, Darwin's Black Box by Michael Behe, which, is one of the main books on intelligent design.
Yeah.
And I found it very convincing. It was very detailed about different biochemical processes, and that fascinated me. And the idea is that there's just no way that A can lead to B, can lead to C, to make certain biochemical parts,
right,
of different animals or bodies. And so, you know, that kind of sealed me in young earth creationism for a long time. And so then I went off to college and majored in chemistry. And I took some biology classes, including a class, it was called zoology. So it's mainly about animals.
Okay.
But there was a lot of population genetics in it, which relies a bit on evolution.
Yeah.
And the way that he presented the information really laid the foundation for some of my later understanding of evolution, even though it was ostensibly a young earth creationist perspective class. So he taught like the different relationships between the animals and how this body part that formed kind of turned into this body part in this other type of organism.
Right.
It couldn't really phrase it that way.
Yeah.
And so it was really awkward in a way, because we were learning the information, but we were told that this is just kind of a convenient way to categorize information rather than it's actually true about the history of what happened.
Right.
And I also learned, you know, a lot of biochemistry and genetics. And so I eventually went to graduate school and got my master's in chemistry and PhD in biochemistry. And the whole time I was still believing in young earth creationism.
Okay.
My, you know, colleagues and bosses, you know, were all about evolution. And I, you know, they would occasionally deride people who believed in young earth creationism, and I just kind of brushed it off.
Yes.
Partly because the way I was taught it in college is there's a difference between types of evolution. There would be microevolution and macroevolution.
Yeah.
And they said microevolution occurs. And microevolution would be like small changes, like maybe one species to another, but, you know, not really, you know, a whole genus to another genus, right, or whatever.
Right.
And so I could accept that some evolution was happening, just not that it had happened in major changes, right, in the past. And so like most of the evolution that was presented to me, even in grad school, I was like, yeah, okay, maybe that happened, but it was just like a small change. And so I could mostly fit it in with my way of thinking. But I hadn't really accepted that, no, there's really no way, like, the big changes definitely happened.
Yeah, yes. You know, first of all, I'll just say that, you know, I wasn't personally a young Earth creationist, but a part of my story is that in the time period of intelligent design, as writers began to write about this. And I just distinctly remember reading Privileged Planet. And again, it's very science-y. Right, it's science adjacent. It's got, and so, and I felt just that pull of, man, I really love this. You know, it was describing, you know, the relationship between the Earth and the Moon and the Sun and the, you know, eclipses, leading to discovery of the universe, and in ways that wouldn't be true if that particular relationship of size and distance didn't occur. But it was just setting up these interesting tidbits of information without really proving anything. And I remember that was kind of one moment where the honesty started to creep in. And I thought, you know, I really believe this, but this doesn't sound, the argument's really not making as strong a conclusion as it thinks that it is. So is that part of, let's go with Lars here, is that part of what dropped your confidence in the existence of God? Was it that, about the, I think you mentioned epistemology, about the process of science, or was it something else?
Well, honestly, no. It wasn't until after I realized that I understood evolution that I really delved into the philosophy of science.
Okay.
I wanted to make sure that I was right, or that I see if I wasn't right. I should say the recognition that I understood enough evolution to acknowledge it as true kicked off years, which continue today, of, as I call it, rage learning, where
yes,
I am voraciously, actively learning all the many things that I was denied,
yeah,
because of the indoctrination of young Earth creationism. The young Earth part had actually dropped away, I don't know, sometime around 2005, 2006. When I was a kid, I went many summers to a summer camp in Southern Pennsylvania, and going from right near Washington, D.C. up there, we have to pass through a road cut called the Sidling Hill Road Cut. And if you've ever seen it, it is fantastic. If you haven't, look it up on Wikipedia. They've got an excellent photo of it. It's just an amazing set of folded strata, several hundred feet high, and the road is cut entirely through it. You can see layers of many different kinds of rock, of coal. It's just beautiful. And seeing that on the way there, on the way back, year after year, sometimes going with my siblings as they were dropped off to the same camp, it wasn't the only thing, but it was one of the things that just stewed in my brain over and over, realizing this could not possibly be the result of a single global flood. It could not be the result of a short time. It's the bottom of what was once folded up on either side, and now the harder rock at the top has eroded away, leaving what was once the bottom, the top. There's just no way for that kind of erosion to have occurred in the amount of time young Earth creationists give, let alone the deposition of the rocks, the folding of the rocks, or deposition turning into rock, and then folding later into mountains. None of it makes any sense in the context of young Earth or global flood. And that, plus the one time I went to a different summer camp, also a Christian camp, of course, they showed the Hubble Deep Field image, which, again, if you haven't seen it, please go look it up. It's a fantastic view of galaxies upon galaxies upon galaxies reaching out into the furthest distance that we can possibly see. of what looks like, at first glance, to be a blank area of the sky. And while it was presented to me as showcasing the majesty and the power of God, all I saw was light that I shouldn't be able to see, and I knew it. Ah. I knew that light speed was constant. And again, it didn't immediately make me say, aha, the universe must be old, but it stuck in my head. And by the time I'd graduated from college, without even meaning to, I'd abandoned the idea of a young Earth. Also in college was the only time I tried arguing for creationism on the internet. I argued that humans couldn't add information and was immediately shown how they could.
Yes.
And never used that argument again. And I've heard on your podcast how you found yourself often agreeing with the conclusions of apologists while disagreeing with their arguments. And that was the first time I remember having that particular cognitive dissonance where I still held to creationism, but I knew that argument was wrong.
Right. Let me ask just a quick question, yes or no. When you let go of young Earth creationism, maybe your confidence dropped, but you were still believed, yes?
It's hard to answer that yes or no.
Okay.
My active belief stopped immediately.
Okay.
I could no longer say, I believe in God. But at the same time, I wouldn't have said, I disbelieve.
Okay.
That I believe God is not real. I just couldn't believe, even if I wanted to at the time.
Okay.
And what followed was several years of wanting to, trying to, looking up apologetics. So I studied apologetics. I was looking for something, anything outside of myself that I could hang my faith on. Because despite being very much about the personal experience themselves, my parents had done a very good job of teaching me in some ways skeptical thinking. They reminded me, do not lean on your own understanding. So I didn't. Just because I felt something, I knew it didn't mean it was true.
Yeah.
They reminded me that just because something sounds amazing and someone reports it, that doesn't mean it's true. Because for a while as a preteen, I read a lot about things like Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, and UFOs, partly inspired, in fact, by Answers in Genesis' insistence that the Loch Ness Monster was a surviving plesiosaur, as if that would put a wrench in evolution.
Yes.
And they disabused me of that idea. They reminded me there's no actual evidence for this, and inadvertently laid the grounds for taking that one step further later on in my life. So, no, as soon as I found out that evolution was true, I didn't ever actually believe again.
Okay.
But I didn't stop trying until about 2 years ago.
So, similar question to Christy then. As you were losing confidence in young Earth creationism or gaining confidence in evolutionary theory, macro evolutionary theory, were you still able to hold on to some faith during that time period, or was it a total drop in belief?
I think I had a bit more faith still than Lars did. There were still some more things for me to lose. One of them was the inerrancy of the Bible. I could still, write Genesis away as being more allegorical or something like that. It wasn't really until the inerrancy fell away that I really lost all the faith, but it definitely significantly diminished.
Lars, you mentioned in your email that you at one point read Rob Bell's book, Velvet Elvis, and the idea of stretchy doctrines. But what the thing that I really related to is you said that it helped you to both precipitated the loss of faith, but also helped you to hang on to it for longer. So I'd like you to explore that a little bit, and then we'll have Christy talk about that as well.
Yeah, this was shortly after I graduated college. I was involved in two different Bible studies with two different groups of friends from two different churches. Again, I was very active as a believer. And in one of them, we were going through the, at the time, new book, Velvet Elvis. And in it, I had a lot of realizations. One of them was that, by all appearances, Rob Bell was receiving great blessing from God, even though I knew that I disagree with him on a number of doctrinal issues. And that helped me broaden my scope of what was acceptable doctrine. Around that time, I stopped seeing Catholics as superstitious idol worshippers and began to see them as actual Christians.
Right.
I also, in that book, encountered the concept of stretchy doctrine, wherein Rob Bell uses the analogy of a trampoline with multiple springs, with each spring representing a piece of doctrine, as opposed to a stack of bricks, where if you take one out, the whole thing topples over. And so that helped me have the freedom to adjust my doctrine as I learned more and as my views changed. And so in that study, that was the first time also that I heard a Christian say that we don't necessarily need to stand against the civil institution of gay marriage. And I argued against it at the time, but I was later convinced by those same people that it wasn't really an issue that we needed to be concerned about, because it's a civil matter. It's not a matter of the kingdom of God, right?
Okay.
And so that stretchiness allowed me to adapt my doctrines as I encountered more and more things that were inconsistent with what I'd originally been told. But at the same time, because I was adapting so much, it meant that some of those doctrines would go by the wayside here and there. And looking back, I don't know if I can think of a single time in my entire life when, given a choice between following existing doctrine or going with conscience or knowledge, that I ever went with doctrine.
Right.
Except once, and that was shortly after we had our first child. We spanked him for a few months and then stopped. We just couldn't do it.
Right. I think that's a big one for a lot of parents.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. They suddenly see themselves. Wow. Christy. So again, similar question of, did you have this concept of stretchy doctrines for yourself as well? Like, you've mentioned having to let go of inerrancy. Were you able to kind of adapt as time went along? What you felt was critical?
I would say that I had, you know, a fair amount of stretchiness in my thinking, in that I could change my views, but by the time that I was convinced that evolution was true, there wasn't really much stretching left to do. There was just either the Bible is inerrant or it isn't, and it has to be fully inerrant for that to be true.
Right.
And so even one thing being, you know, contradictory makes it fall apart.
Right.
And I was presented with many things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's only so much stretching you can do when that happens. I just couldn't reconcile it in my mind. Like, you know, how do I approach the Bible now? And, you know, I kept on trying to figure out how other people believe.
Same here.
Or, you know, why they keep practicing when they find out that, you know, the Bible has mistakes.
Right.
And, you know, I never figured it out. And so eventually I stopped.
One thing that I find interesting is when I talk to Christian apologists who are kind of studying the concept of deconversion or deconstruction, is they will often point to things like young earth creationism as being at fault. So I'm curious to both of you, if you had been raised in a slightly more theologically liberal environment, do you think you would still be a believer?
I think I probably would. I mean, if you presented me with, you know, the philosophy of, like, just why faith in general is not a good epistemology, and, you know, presented me with all the ways that the Bible is errant, then yeah, I probably wouldn't believe. But it would have taken a lot longer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the young earth creationist concept was wrapped up with inerrancy. And so having that young earth creationism be proven false caused me to question inerrancy, whereas I might not have questioned it before.
Okay.
For me, I might have remained a Christian longer, or I might have actually left sooner. I honestly don't know, because looking back, I can say that almost any time I encountered cognitive dissonance, such as looking at the atrocities perpetrated or endorsed by God in the Bible, or the contradictions or inconsistencies in it, or statements that are just false, I noticed them, or at least some of them, and just shoved them away to that part of my mind that said, I'll find out the answer to this later.
Right.
And I call it the mental flinch, where there's a thought and you can see it coming and you know you don't like where it's going and you just swerve to
yes.
some other thought. So I'm quite sure that if at some point I had sat down and taken the time to learn philosophy and epistemology like I have since recognizing that evolution is true, I would also have had to abandon faith, because faith simply isn't knowledge, and it never can be.
We'll jump into epistemology maybe a little deeper in a few minutes, but I think something that the listeners will really be interested in is, you know, how you told each other. So which one of you kind of made a kind of conscious decision first, and then how did you inform each other?
So I was thinking about bringing it up. Well, we've been out of church for the whole pandemic, but our church provided online services, but we never listened to them or watched them.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, we just let our friends and family assume that we were listening to and watching them, but we didn't say otherwise. So, like, we both kind of noticed that neither one of us was even trying to you know, watch the church services
right.
or whatever.
Right.
And the pandemic was sort of winding down in that, you know, things were going back to in-person, you know, whether they should be or not. And so we realized that, like, friends and family were going to be expecting to see us sometime soon. And so I knew the conversation had to happen eventually. And so we had a date away from the kids, and I was thinking about bringing it up. We went to Olive Garden, but they're super efficient there. And so they, you know, they brought our food really fast, and then we ate it really fast, and there was just no conversation.
Yeah.
But like, I was definitely thinking about bringing it up. And then I'll let Lars tell what happened after that.
So a few days later, I got a message from a friend of mine who used to be the leader of the Bible study I mentioned, in which we studied Velvet Elvis. And he asked me, hey, so where are you these days on matters of faith?
Yeah.
And I knew that if I was going to respond to him, I had to respond to Christy first. And so that night, after the kids were in bed, I brought it up. I said, my friend has sent me this message about matters of faith, and I have to tell you, I just don't have any. And I'm sure you know this feeling, as have many of the people you've interviewed. It's like immediately a ton of bricks fell off my shoulders. It's the same feeling that I imagine people have when they describe the joy of salvation when they become Christians. I never had that feeling, and I always wondered if it was something wrong with me. And now I understand that it's the euphoria of understanding your own identity
and yes.
being aware and honest about it. It's just an amazing feeling.
That's awesome. Yeah. And you guys are, I think, very lucky, right, for that to have kind of happened simultaneously for both of you. That's amazing. It's also interesting that you can go back to previous episodes at the early part of the pandemic, where I was theorizing that we might get exactly what you've described. People who, you know, we're no longer physically in the building at church, and, you know, start to slide away because you're out of context, right? You're not singing every week. You're not actively, you know, collectively praying. You're not listening to a sermon, and it lets you think about why, you know, do I believe this or don't I? So do you think that that had a major part in at least becoming able to admit it to yourselves?
Well, I admitted it to myself sometime early in 2019. It was, I want to say, shortly before my best friend passed away, because I remember at his funeral in March, grieving, but also knowing that I wouldn't see him again. And perhaps somewhat surprisingly to myself, it was all right. I could make peace with that fact. Mm. And, you know, I still remember him very fondly. And he was definitely one of my last links to faith. So at his funeral, I knew that I wouldn't see him again. And I was able to process it. And at the same time, I still kept attending church for another year and a half. Some part of me still hoping that maybe that would be the Sunday that the pastor would say something that would bring the faith coming back.
Yeah.
So right before the pandemic, the pastor preached on what was then a new story, the story of Rhett and Link of Ear Biscuits and their deconversion.
Yeah.
And I thought, maybe this time, maybe I'll hear what I need to hear to believe again. And the only reason the pastor gave for why faith was important was because faith was important. And I still wasn't quite ready to tell Christy that I definitely didn't believe, but I did mention to her my disappointment with the fact that he didn't give any real reasons.
Yeah.
So maybe that right there would be the very last gasp of faith for me.
And then Christy, was the absence of church a part of that for you, or had you already made your mind up at that point?
I think I had lost faith, but I wasn't ready to admit it fully to myself and definitely not to other people yet.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of concern about telling our parents, and I knew as soon as Lars and I talked about it, we would have to tell people because, you know, he's an honest guy and that's just how we are. So, you know, I was trying to avoid the conversation because I didn't want to tell our parents yet. With especially with Lars's parents, you know, you'd think that it would be my parents that I would be the most concerned about because they're mine, but it's really Lars's parents that I was the most concerned about.
Yeah.
Because it's their whole life. It's their livelihood and, you know, everything that they stand for is Christianity. So, I didn't really believe, but having the pandemic, being able to stay home and feeling the relief of not having to go to church, you know, made me realize, you know, I don't want to go back.
Yeah. Wow.
For me, I was avoiding it because I didn't want to shake whatever faith she and the kids may have had, because even if I couldn't have it, I didn't want to take that away from them.
Right.
Or at least that's part of it. I think the other part was also I didn't want to tell my parents.
Okay. So some interesting themes have come out of this, you know, the idea of just intellectual honesty, the relief when you are honest with yourself and others, identity. And Lars, you've hinted at, you know, the ability to take credit for your successes. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Having heard, I think I listened to every single one of your episodes, actually.
Well, thank you.
having heard the many other interviews you've done, I've noticed that my recovery, if you will, my reconstruction, happened in reverse order from many people. I'd actually gotten over a lot of the bad parts of fundamentalism before actually giving up the faith.
Right.
So, for example, taking credit for my own accomplishments and my own abilities. Growing up, that was always equated with pride, right? So everything that was accomplished was according to the Lord's will or with the Lord's help. And yet, I knew that in many things I was quite capable, and this always sad intention with me. So the first thing that I remember where I stopped acting in faith and started just acting was looking online for a date. I was single and didn't like it. And I had either asked out or decided not to ask out everyone I knew. So I went on some dating sites and set up a profile. And it worked out well. That's why we're married now.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. And, you know, I got results instead of just praying and hoping that someday a girl would throw herself at me.
Yes.
I did something about it.
Yeah.
And we really hit the jackpot. We're very, very well matched for each other. We don't just say so. Everyone else does too.
Yeah.
We think in sync. We have similar interests, but not so similar that we smother each other.
Right.
And after that, it was one success after another. My life has improved considerably since I was a depressed, just coming out of college, 20-something. And in each case, it's been because I did something about it, or someone did something for me.
Right.
And that was just one of the many things that I unlearned before actually leaving faith behind. The other big thing, as it is with many, especially people who grew up in the 90s and 2000s like we did, was purity culture. So I was, of course, taught that it's very important to keep yourself for marriage. And for me, that wasn't a problem. I heard about sex with one very awkward conversation on my 11th birthday, and it remains one of the single worst events in my entire life.
Okay.
In terms of the negative impact it had on me at the time.
Okay.
And I was so utterly repulsed by the idea, having been inadvertently taught that certain parts of my body are evil, that I had no interest in it. Now, I've later realized that's because I am on the plus side of LGBTQ+. I am demisexual. I just don't really find the idea of sex interesting unless I'm already in a romantic relationship with someone.
Right.
And so when we were engaged, I brought up to Christy that I just wasn't that interested in sex. And being conditioned by entertainment that women are always disgusted by sex anyway, I assumed she would be okay with this. And of course she was not.
And fun conversation, I'm sure. Yeah.
Fortunately, the pastor that we were seeing for our premarital counseling was very helpful in that. And I also read some books that tried to put sex in a more positive light, even within a Christian framework.
Right.
And I was still a little leery going up to the wedding night, but things went well.
Okay.
They've gone well ever since. But it's that that failure of the church to acknowledge the spectrum of sexuality,
right,
and the fact that not all men are raging horn dogs and not all women are prudes.
Yeah.
That really hurt us a lot and could have hurt us worse had things not gotten better for us when we got married.
Christy, do you want to respond to that? What was that like? What was that conversation like?
Yeah, I mean, I was very interested in sex, so it kind of blew my mind that he wasn't.
Yeah.
And it was pretty difficult. You know, looking back on it, I think we were pretty stupid to get married without knowing whether we could have sex or not, like whether it was going to work.
That's a pretty big deal. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, it did end up working out. But yeah, it was pretty weird.
Yeah.
Because I was like the complete opposite. Like I really wanted to have sex.
Yeah. That's a reason to get married. If you're a Christian, you're like, yeah, we
were. Yeah, exactly. You know, if you're not allowed to have sex until you're married, then you better get married fast.
Yes.
So you can go ahead and have sex.
Exactly. Well, I appreciate you guys. Thank you so much, both of you, for the honesty on that level. I don't think we talk about it enough, but it continues to not surprise me, but shock me at how devastating purity culture has been for people. It doesn't matter if you're male, female, non-binary, you know, what you are, if you grew up in that time period, you've been really impacted strongly by that purity culture. And for many, many people in very deeply negative ways. So again, thank you for sharing that part. I I want to switch topics just a little bit and talk a little bit about this idea of epistemology. Lars, you brought it up a few times. Big philosophical word. It just means, how do we know what we know, or how do we come to know what we know? Both of you can talk about this. The differences between how you think now, or how you come to know things are true now, in comparison to revelation or matters of faith.
So after having what I call my evolutionary epiphany, I realized if I were to actually be able to know anything, and to know that indeed I was now more correct than I was before, that I needed to know how to know things. And fortunately, the internet is full of counter-creationism, and along with the counters to creationism often comes primers in the philosophy of science. And so in reading and watching many different sources, I started to get some idea of how can science at least be used to say that we do or don't know something. And this got me thinking more generally, how do I know anything at all? And I've had to realize that to the extent that we take absolute certainty as knowledge, then there really can't be any. So if knowing is to have any meaning at all, it's just going to be confidence, to the point where it would be life-changing to find out that I was wrong. That's how I use the word now. And part of the reason I use it that way is because when I was younger, I knew that young earth creationism was true. And when I found out that it was wrong, it was indeed life-changing to find out that it was wrong.
Right.
And now I see my former faith in the same way, that I knew God existed, and now that I realize I never actually had a good reason to think that, it's life-changing to find out that I was wrong. Or at least technically misguided from an epistemological sense.
Right. But you've gained something. You've learned new knowledge.
Pretty much gained the ability to have a much more solid worldview, where I can be confident in saying, I do know this, and I don't know that, and it's okay not to know. Christians are often taught to always have an answer, and I think they take that to be more than just an answer for the hope that is in them, but an answer for literally anything and everything. Yeah. And that's where you get groups like Answers in Genesis or the many other apologetics resources out there that try to give an answer for just about anything, not just apologetics, but Christian self-help.
Right.
Bookstores are full of these books that are ostensibly based on the Bible, mostly just based on what the author thinks is good advice and manages to find some Bible verses to go along with it.
Yeah.
But all that to say, basing things on because the Bible says so is simply taking a claim at face value. And epistemologically, that's not going to fly. You can't simply believe something because someone says it. If someone says it, they need to be able to demonstrate it, or you don't need to accept the claim. Mm-hmm. And as I realized that was true for creationism, I also realized that was true for every other aspect of my faith, or literally anything at all that I knew. And now that I can be confident in what I do and don't know, I'm much less often flummoxed by some idea where I don't know if I should accept it or not. I can quickly, usually, find out if it's worth accepting.
And Christy, similar question about how you come to know things are true or not now versus how you used to with faith.
Yeah, so I've been familiar with the scientific method, you know, for a very long time, and I teach it as, you know, part of my living. And I feel like in many ways my epistemology hasn't changed, in that something needs to have sufficient evidence to accept it. I just thought there was sufficient evidence for Christianity, right, and now I don't.
Yeah.
Same here.
So there wasn't really, in some senses, that much faith that I had before either. It was more a sense of, you know, I thought there was evidence for these certain things that, you know, were in the Bible, and that, you know, I thought that would allow me to accept the rest of the Bible, which I now realize is not logical. But it was presented as like, if we have evidence for these particular parts of the Bible, then we can trust the whole thing. And so, you know, I did trust the whole thing. And that's kind of my idea of faith is, you know, those parts that we didn't have the evidence for, I'm still believing them, but it was because I had the evidence for the other parts.
Right.
She said that better than I could.
I think that's really eloquent that, you know, that you already believed in evidence. I hear all the time from apologists, it's about evidence. It's just that they are convinced by the existing evidence for this enormous claim. And part of that, this process is just recognizing that that evidence is insufficient for the enormity of the claim.
I would actually disagree with you on the apologists. Most of them, when properly pressed, will acknowledge that their belief is founded on their internal witness of the Holy Spirit as they see it, their gut feeling that it's true. The apologetics is just a method for supporting what they already believe to be true. Even William Lane Craig, who's one of the most famous modern apologists, has said this on camera.
Hmm. I'd really love that clip. Because I think that
I'll get it for you later.
I completely agree with you, Lars, that that is the case. I don't hear it admitted, or at least that explicitly, very often at all. But good point. Excellent point.
Oh, yeah. In addition to the, you know, the pre-recovery aspects, I'd encountered secular community before ever even questioning my faith. Shortly after graduating college, I got an apartment with a friend from one of the churches that I was going to a singles group at. And I was introduced, or sorry, with two of the friends, and one of them introduced us to the show Firefly, which I'm guessing you're familiar with. Yes. As a sci-fi fan.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Okay. It was just the best as far as I was concerned. And so shortly thereafter, we joined a Firefly fan club and met about once a month for lunch in Northern Virginia for the next several years. And this was probably the most diverse group of people I've ever been around. People from many different ethnicities, socioeconomic backgrounds, and importantly, religious ones too. There were people who were at least nominally Christian. I was clearly the most fundamentalist of the Christians there, but I encountered a Unitarian atheist. I encountered some just casual atheists, and the interaction with them helped me realize that the stereotype of atheists as dour, miserable, cruel people was obviously not true. These are, in fact, some of the happiest, most interesting people I knew.
Right.
And they also introduced me to the idea of sci-fi conventions. And so not long after that, I first went to DragonCon in Atlanta. I just wrapped up this past weekend. It's a huge sci-fi, fantasy, comic book, everything else convention. Takes place in Atlanta, Georgia, every year over Labor Day weekend. And it has ever afterward been my happy place.
Yes.
It's where I can be with my people. And much later during my deconstruction phase, shortly after recognizing that evolution was true, I read the Book of Acts to try to find some faith again. And I realized that the community that they were experiencing was the same kind, the same exuberance that I experienced at DragonCon. And that did not bolster my faith. Rather, it showed me that faith wasn't necessary for the kind of thing that Acts says faith is necessary for.
That actually just people getting together in a common purpose and enjoying each other's company is the magic. That is the magic of community. Yeah, that's awesome. So we've talked about how you guys told each other, but you've got some other members of the family. So how did you tell the kids and what was their reaction?
So we went on a family camping trip shortly after we had talked to each other about it. And so we decided that was a pretty good time to tell our kids. And they were the first ones that we told.
Okay.
So we sat around the campfire and Lars asked them, You know, is there anything that you've noticed that we used to do, but we don't do anymore? Yeah. And the answer was going to church.
Yes.
And they eventually hit on the answer we were looking for, and we started talking about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we have three kids. Our oldest is Teddy. He's 9. The next is Amy. She's 7. And the youngest is Eleanor, who is 5.
Okay.
And each of them has had very different approaches to church and theology. Teddy has always been a skeptic. He has always been interested in epistemology himself. And so we've often had long discussions about how we know what we know. And before I was ready to admit to my family that I didn't believe, he'd made a lot of inferences and realized that we didn't have any better reason to believe in God than in Santa Claus. He made this particular observation after watching the Tim Allen movie of the same name last Christmas.
Yes.
Our second one, Amy, has always been the most theologically minded. She would often, when noting that nobody could do something, pipe up with, "Except God." So she was always the one most in tune with what she, you know, deemed her spiritual side, which right. is something I've never really felt that I had. And the youngest, Eleanor, mostly just goes for the snacks.
Okay. All right. So we have with us on camera, the listeners aren't going to be able to see this, but who do we have here? We have Teddy and
Amy.
And Amy. Very good. You guys, when your mom and dad mentioned that you were no longer going to church, what was your reaction?
So I was like, so now I realize that, and it makes sense.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure church wasn't very interesting to me.
Okay.
But like, it wasn't very surprising to me.
Okay. And Amy, do you miss it? Do you wish you were still going to church? A little bit, yeah. Did you have friends there?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
One time I said, "Love, magic isn't real and God is, then how is he real?" Well, Daddy didn't really give an answer because he didn't want to say yes.
I see, okay. So you recognized that magic wasn't real, and you felt like God was like magic too, so how could he be real?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And we've got Eleanor, is that right? How did you feel when your daddy said that you guys were no longer going to church?
Scared.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and why?
I don't know.
Okay. That's okay. That's all right. Well, you guys are all amazing. I really appreciate you for telling us your story and having the kids say everything. So one more time, can we get everybody's names just so we can make sure that everybody gets
I'm Amy.
Amy, okay.
Eleanor,
all right.
Teddy.
And Teddy.
And Teddy.
All right, Teddy. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
Oh, there's one other thing. If people want to interact with me on some of my favorite topics, I help run a Facebook group called Answers to Answers in Genesis.
Oh, great. Okay.
It is a faith-friendly and friendly faith forum, as we call it, where we don't disparage faith and we don't allow anyone else to do it either. And if you are a person of faith, we don't allow you to disparage those without it. But it's a place to discuss creationism and what's wrong with it from both a theological and scientific standpoint.
Great. If you give me that link, we'll put that in the show notes.
Great.
Lars and Christy, again, thank you for all the honesty. Thank you for sharing your family with us. This has been really, really amazing. So thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Final thoughts on the episode. There's a lot to unpack here. I do want to reiterate one more time that we were not trying to ask leading questions to the children. The kids had told Lars and Christy those stories beforehand, and we were trying to get them to say it on mic, which of course doesn't always work. The family is lovely. I think their story is profound. As I said at the top of the podcast, I think what you can hear is both how intelligence helps a person come out of faith and how intelligence allows one to prolong it. So Lars talked about reading Rob Bell and the stretchy theology that prolonged his faith. And Christy talks about being able to compartmentalize as she's an active scientist and understands evolution, but able to put it off to the side and ignore it. That really spoke to me. That is something that I related to a lot. It's that ability to absorb something into your worldview and not let it affect real criticism your worldview. I also found it fascinating that both Lars and Christy said that they felt there was sufficient evidence. And I think this goes back to, again, very intelligent people being able to fool themselves to compartmentalize. And we see that so much with apologetics, where these are very, very, very bright people. And they believe in evidence. They believe in the scientific method, but they are not applying it consistently. Christy also talks about believing that there's enough evidence for parts of the Bible. Let's say you believe there's enough evidence for the resurrection, and then applying that to the rest of the Bible, rather than thinking critically about each individual piece. When Lars said, "It's not like I don't believe in God," to his spiritual mentors, and suddenly realizing that in fact he did not, even though it took him years to then admit it to himself in totality, Lars says the better part of faith is hope, and that he had hope for years. I think there are so many people who are in that spot where they are trying to make it work. They are trying to believe. They hope that they can believe, but they don't. I loved Lars talking about rage learning. That really spoke to me as well. In my blog post, Deconversion and 10 Easy Steps, I talk about both the permission to doubt phase and the information gathering phase. That information gathering phase is right after you have admitted to yourself that you no longer believe, and then it's just a floodgate of information that you are now allowed to go and explore. Christy talked about the relief of not having to go to church any longer. During the pandemic, when they were expected to be watching church online, she was freed up to no longer have to do that. And it's amazing that both Lars and Christy were kind of avoiding that and hadn't yet told one another. Lars trying to protect the rest of the family, and Christy trying to figure out how she could bring up the subject. I also wanted to thank Lars and Christy for talking about something that is difficult, about Lars's demisexuality. That might have been a very difficult conversation for them when they were first getting married, and I appreciated that they had the honesty to talk about that on mic. I want to thank Lars and Christy for being on the podcast, for their honesty and sharing their family with us. We got to see the process of deconstruction and deconversion and the freedom that they are experiencing on the other side. Thank you to the whole family, to Lars, Christy, Teddy, Amy, and Eleanor. The Secular Grace Thought of the Week is about freedom and integrity. So much of Lars and Christy's story is about withholding the power of their own critical thinking and the relief that they felt once they applied that to their own sacred beliefs. A common theme that comes up within the podcast is how surprised people are after deconversion, after they have admitted to themselves that they no longer believe. The peace, the freedom, all of the things that they were promised as a Christian, they suddenly experience as a deconvert. I think Lars said this best, that he experienced what he believed Christianity describes as the salvation experience of being free and honest about yourself. Intellectual integrity and brutal self-honesty is absolutely amazing and freeing. The trick is that it takes two elements. It takes the methodology and consistency. So when we talk about epistemology, how we come to know what is true, or how we determine what is true, that methodology, the scientific method, is built to overcome our own ability to fool ourselves. It means that other people can be critical of our arguments, and we should thank them for that. We should be grateful. If someone points out to me that I'm wrong, I've learned something. And if we have that attitude of humility and of seeking after actual truth, we will welcome that. That is a difficult emotional trait to develop, but it leads to more intellectual freedom, more peace, and more freedom. But the methodology is only half the equation. The other half is consistency. Will you apply it to the things that you hold most dear? The obvious example of that is our former religious belief. But it doesn't end there. There are many groups of secular people online that have belief systems that they will defend. And it is our ability to consistently apply that methodology to our own beliefs, to the things we hold dear, that leads to truth. You've heard me quote over and over and over again, but Jesus was right. The truth will set you free. The actual truth will set you free. And so seeking after the truth, no matter where that comes from, no matter how world-shaking, in Lars's terms, learning that he was wrong would change his worldview, would shake his world, those kinds of moments are profound and life-altering in a positive and good way, even though we might be very emotional through that process. We have a number of Deconversion Anonymous episodes coming up that I'm very excited about. I've finally been able to get interviews going, and so we have a good queue of interviews in the bag and several more coming up. I also just want to mention several of you have responded to my request for participation, and I have really failed to get back to you. So again, I will get to you soon. My apologies for taking so long. But I am excited about what is going on with the podcast. It feels like we have some real energy. It sounds like the listeners out there are really getting some value from the podcast. And so thank you to the listeners of the podcast. You guys are what makes this work. So until the next time, my name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. Time for the footnotes. The beat is called Waves from Makai Beats. Links will be in the show notes. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can promote it on your social media. You can subscribe to it in your favorite podcast application, and you can rate and review it on podchaser.com. You can also support the podcast by clicking on the affiliate links for books on gracefulatheist.com. If you have podcast production experience and you would like to participate with the podcast, please get in touch with me. Have you gone through a faith transition and do you need to tell your story? Reach out. If you are a creator or work in the deconstruction, deconversion, or secular humanism spaces and would like to be on the podcast, just ask. If you'd like to financially support the podcast, there's links in the show notes. To find me, you can Google Graceful Atheist, you can Google Deconversion, you can Google Secular Grace, you can send me an email, gracefulatheist@gmail.com, or you can check out the website, gracefulatheist.com. My name is David, and I am trying to be the graceful atheist. Join me and be graceful human beings. This has been the Graceful Atheist Podcast.